Members, we are going to get going, and we're going to start with Representative Eklund's bill. We do not have, I think we're one short of quorum at this point, but we're going to start hearing testimony, and hopefully somebody else will come in. We have it sent out the APB. So with that, Representative Eklund, welcome to the committee. And I will move House File 2720 so that it is before the committee. And Representative Eklund, you've got, is this the A1? I assume this is an author's amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, it is.
I will go ahead and offer the A1 amendment as well. Any questions about that? Seeing none, all those in favor of the adoption of the A1 amendment to get the bill in the shape the author would like it to be, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Now the bill is in the shape that we the author would like it to be in, and now we have a quorum, so we're legal. With that, Representative Eklund, to your bill.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And first off, I screwed up last week at my first bill was heard. Didn't bring treats, so I made sure I did today. So go ahead and pass cookies around and enjoy yourselves. So.
Thank you, Representative Eklund. We very much appreciate that.
Mr. Chair, this bill is a result of some legislation that passed in 2014 on some rule changes. Most of it is in the works as far as the rule changes, so I'll direct the committee to Section 3.13. This is the main part of the bill that we're talking about. It's sawmills located in a county with a population of less than 8,000. According to the last federal census, that utilize steam for drying of lumber are not required to meet the high-pressure boiler attendance requirements set forth in Minnesota Rules Part 5225.118. And then what we're doing here, Mr. Chairman, is the rulemaking is going on, and we're just the amendment speaks to offering the exemption for or the change for the rule to go on for another sunset for another 5 years or the date upon which the new rules get effect are in effect. And I brought with me Mr. Howard Hedstrom from Hedstrom Lumber, and he could speak more directly to what we're
welcome, Mr. Hedstrom. Could I identify yourself for the record and proceed?
Mr. Chair, members, I'm Howard Hedstrom, president of Hedstrom Lumber in Grand Marais. So we've been operating under this exemption for a couple of years or a year and a half now. We've invested in our boiler controls. You know, we're doing everything, you know, in the rule. I was on the rule committee with Mr. Sprung, who's in the audience over here. And the Department of Labor is working on the rule. They don't have it done by the sunset of the original legislation, and this just gives us the ability to operate seamlessly until that happens. So I appreciate your consideration.
That sounds good to me. Members, any questions? Not seeing any. Is there anybody else that wants to speak for or against this bill? Seeing none, Representative Eklund, excuse me, I will give you the final word.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And being new at this, I assume I need to move House File 2720.
I will do that since I moved it earlier. Since you could, but you're not on the committee, it would have to be one of our committee members. So with that, I will renew my motion that. I will renew my motion that House File 2720 as amended be recommended to pass or be re-referred to the Committee on Jobs. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevailed. You're on your way to jobs.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Eklund. Thank you, Mr. Hedstrom. And thank you for the treats.
Thank you.
Representative Lohmer. I thought I saw, there you are. We have a volunteer to move this fine piece of legislation so it's before the committee. Representative Anderson, thank you. Representative Anderson will move that House File 3369 be referred to the Public Committee on Public Safety. Representative Lohmer, welcome to the committee. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for hearing House File 3369 today. I'll share just a brief explanation of what this bill is intending to do and then introduce you to my testifier. So current law in Minnesota, current Minnesota laws do not consider sensory testing services and their unique yet critical role in product development and quality assurance. The bill being discussed today will allow St. Croix Sensory to conduct sensory evaluation of products containing alcohol under the controlled direct oversight of the Minnesota Department of Public Safety. This includes purchases through a wholesaler, holding product on site and presentation of samples to a trained testing panel of assessors. The bill has been reviewed and is supported by Michelle Tushner, Director of Minnesota DPS. So I'd like to introduce Michael McGinley. He's the Laboratory Director of St. Croix Sensory. Michael is second generation owner of a sensory testing business started in Stillwater in 1980. St. Croix Sensory conducts sensory testing studies on products and materials for companies all over the world. St. Croix Sensory has recently responded to inquiries for sensory testing for products containing alcohol from companies in Minnesota, the U.S., Mexico, and South America. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Lohmer. Mr. McGinley, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Michael McGinley with a company called St. Croix Sensory. We do sensory testing. Most people can imagine or participated in food taste testing in the past. Our company is growing from doing nuisance odor work for agricultural and other industries around the state and country. And over the years have expanded into doing testing of air fresheners, packaging materials, water, energy drinks, all kinds of different products. And right now I'm looking at expanding into doing sensory testing of alcohol products, so I wanted to do that in a way that was legal. Currently only able to do that if I were to hire a caterer to be on site all the time when I'm doing this work, so needing to be allowed to do that under oversight from the Department of Public Safety.
Thank you, Mr. McGinley. Questions for members? Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so your firm is doing this, and this bill would actually open up a whole new area for anybody in the state of Minnesota to do it. So it's not specific to your firm. If there's another firm that is doing some type of testing, whether it's focus groups or other types of things, they would have the opportunity to do similar types of sensory testing.
This is specifically written for using trained sensory panels. So in our case, that's, you know, collecting a group of, say, 10 to 20 people that you're training to do this kind of work, as opposed to just bringing in, you know, 100 people off the street. So it's would be open to others doing sensory testing, but under that condition of with trained groups.
Representative Dean.
So I believe that the training period is 1 hour. And if that's the case, it would really allow me or anybody to set up what I would say are focus groups and do the first hour in training and the next couple hours in the actual sensory testing. Am I correct?
Mr. Bates.
This also requires that there'd be a review of that the facility is designed specifically for doing sensory work, that somebody couldn't be just doing this in any common space and calling it sensory testing work.
Representative Dean.
Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions, members? Anybody in the audience that would like to testify in this bill for or against? Not seeing anybody. Representative Lohmer will give you the final word.
Well, I thank you very much for hearing the bill today and for your support, members and Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Lohmer. And with that, Representative Anderson renews her motion that House File 3369 be referred to the Committee on Public Safety. Those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. You are on your way to public safety.
Thank you,
Representative Lohmer.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. Representative Lunan. While you're on your way up, Representative Lunan, did you happen to get a chance to see the minutes today?
I did. I just got done looking them over. I'd like to move the minutes from the last meeting.
Thank you, Representative Lunan. Members, any comments, questions, concerns, corrections? Seeing none, those in favor of the Lunan motion that the minutes from our last meeting be adopted, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Minutes are adopted. Thank you, Representative Lunan. Thank you, members. Representative Lunan, to your bill.
I would like to move bill House File 3246. Members, this bill has two aspects to it, and it deals with auto no-fault losses. And on an auto policy, the first coverage to arrive at a claim is the personal injury protection that everybody collects under their own policy. It doesn't wait to see who was at fault in the accident. And what we're trying to do here is what I consider cleanup or corrections of what the actual intent of the bill was back in 1974. And the first part has to do with the non-medical coverage under no fault that allows an insured to, if you're injured in a car accident and you are the one to mow the lawn or you are the one that cleans your house, and because of the injury of the accident you are not able to do that, we will reimburse you or indemnify you for expenses you incur to have those services performed. And the limit on that is $200 a week. Well, that has since been morphed into a situation where someone gets injured in a car accident, and just the simple fact that they have the coverage, they seek compensation or receiving compensation at the $200 a week, even if they didn't have anyone perform the services. And so we want to tighten that up as far as the definition of a loss, that you actually have to incur the services. The second part is just as straightforward, and I'm going to give you a claim story here. You're traveling down the road, and someone runs into you, and you get notified by either through a mail or a phone call by an attorney, and they recommend that you seek some medical care, and you do. And the insurance company takes a look at and audits these all the time and basically disagrees with the level of the injury or the treatment for the injury. And so they order what is called an independent medical exam. And the doctor comes out, and I question how independent the doctor is. I'm going to want that on the record. But the doctor comes out, does an evaluation as to causation and whether there's an actual injury. And to be quite honest with you, the vast majority of the time, independent medical exams terminate coverage. Of course, independent medical exams are only brought in when there's a questionable, or what the insurance company sees as a questionable situation. So you would expect the batting average to be high. So then what you do is you go after the at-fault party. And in that lawsuit or that litigation, as long as you exceed the tort threshold, you're allowed to do that. You collect fully for your medical bills that you incurred, and you collect fully for your wage loss. That lawsuit is then closed off. You can now turn back around and ask for arbitration on your no-fault claim that you had, your medical claims, and collect all over again for your lost wages and your lost medical. And just like IMEs, which have a suspicious batting average that's very high for terminating coverage, I contend that arbitration has a particularly high batting average for reinstating the coverage, and I suspect a lot of that has to do with the cases that come before them were questionable to begin with, and we've got several arbitrators in the room here, so this should get a pretty thorough vetting. But that's what the bill does, is it's designed to prevent somebody from collecting for a loss or an expense they didn't incur, and the second part is to prevent double dipping or collecting twice for that very same loss. And I have a testifier.
Thank you, Representative Lunan. Do members have questions for Representative Lunan, or do we want to jump into testifiers? Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and this might just be my own not knowing. So under Minnesota state law, if I'm in a car accident and all this happens, can I also sue for pain and suffering and other type of damages as well, or is it purely material to specific lost wages and things of that nature?
Representative Lunan.
Thank you, Representative Dean. The no-fault law was supposed to just indemnify for actual losses incurred, so pain and anguish would not be involved in that. The lawsuit I talked about, you could certainly collect them there outside of that, but that's over in a civil proceeding. The no fault does not address that. It's supposed to be actual loss incurred.
Representative Sundin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Representative, one thing that you didn't talk about, and in my experience with being hit by a drunk driver and laid up for a period of time, you know, I made whole on the wages and some of the services that were provided by other people. But two things that I was not made whole on, and it is pretty tough to chase down, was my pension and my health benefits, because I was working as an hourly worker, and of course they contributed my wages, but if you start to figure out that $6-7 an hour for health insurance, and then the pension and annuity payments that were not paid in, I have to work that much longer when I'm older to be made whole, you know. What can we do? You know, would you entertain an amendment at some point on this bill's journey to improve it so people are made whole on their pensions and health benefits as well?
Representative Luna.
Well, what I would be more comfortable having an attorney answer that, but I'm going to take a shot at it because I'm Irish. The you're the no fault. You may have potential action under no fault under the non-medical for under the replacement services for some of that. But I'm going to there's attorneys. What I was able to do is find attorneys that have worked on both on the plaintiff and the defense side. So I was going for objectivity on this, and they're going to do a much better job at answering that question. That's a very valid question. No fault is not designed to solve that problem, though. That would be what the lawsuit would be designed to take care of, and then going back under your underinsured motorist coverage.
Maybe that's a good time to get Mr. Johnson down here. You're Representative Johnson. I do have some questions for you, though. Welcome back to the committee, and welcome to the committee. Please state your names for record and proceed whenever you're ready to start.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Cindy Butler. I'm an attorney at the law firm of Stitch Angel, Kreidler, Scattergood, or Kreidler, Unke, and Scattergood. I was previously employed by Robbins Kaplan, so another law firm in the city. I did 5 years doing exclusively plaintiff's personal injury work, and now I do defense. So as Representative Lunan indicated, I've got experience on both sides of the equation. I also clerked for a federal judge for 2 years, so I also have the objectivity of that brings to it. But that is why I'm here in part to testify, and I'll allow Mr. Johnson to introduce himself.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, Bob Johnson, Insurance Federation of Minnesota. I'm going to go second of this group.
Welcome back to the committee. Ms. Butler, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As Mr. Lunan alluded to, this No-Fault Act has been in existence for over 30 years. Since its inception, there have been some key policies and purposes inherent in the No-Fault Act. And those include, and this is statutorily prescribed in the No-Fault Act, to provide offsets to avoid duplicate recovery. It also encourages the prompt payment of specified basic economic loss benefits, those personal injury protection benefits that Representative Lunan was talking about, as well as to speed the administration of justice and to prevent court backlog and overload. This bill accomplishes all of those purposes from top to bottom, and it's exactly what the No-Fault Act was intended to do from its inception, but as a result of two recent Supreme Court decisions, that has been abrogated. And so briefly, I'd like to talk about some of those two decisions. The first one, in the first part of this bill, is intended to address the replacement services costs. That is exactly as Representative Lunan discussed, when you can no longer, because of your injuries, perform services around the home that you would typically have done. Things like shoveling the driveway, common issue here, of course, in Minnesota. Things like mowing the lawn, even laundry or cooking services. What happens is if you can no longer perform those services, there is a provision of your no-fault insurance benefits that allows reimbursement. The critical import of this, and what everyone I think sort of assumed would happen, is that those services would actually have been performed. Hence, replacement services. Not just services, but replacement services. They're intended to replace what you would have done for yourself. Under existing case law, in the case of a primary homemaker, it didn't even require you to pay that person. My husband could come in and do those services for me, and I could still get compensation. That stays in place under this current law. What the court in the Schrader decision did is it took it one step further and said, now not only do you not have to pay for those services, you don't even have to have them done. And that's what this bill is designed to affect and correct. So that's where the amended language comes in to say that services have to be actually provided. Not even still that they have to be paid for in the case of a replacement primary homemaker. Different issue for a different day. This is a much more measured and fair approach to correct the basic imbalances and unfairness that is created by the Schrader decision. The Schrader decision, by the way, specifically invited comment and action by the legislature on this issue. In footnote 2, it notes that the insurer involved in that case expressed concern that the insurer should not bear responsibility for paying benefits to a person who neither performed nor purchased replacement services. The court went on to say, regardless of the validity of that position, our hands are tied. And if the No-Fault Act needs revision, it must be the legislature to do that. That is exactly why we're here, to do exactly what the court sort of recognized needed to be done and invite the legislature to do what it also intended to do from the outset. The other part of this provision is in the second part, and this is the duplicate recovery. So this attacks all of those policies and purposes. In the Lennartson decision, as Representative Lunan was discussing, a person went to their insurer, got benefits paid for medical expense, then sued the other driver, got an additional pot of money for medical expenses, and then went back into arbitration and collected an additional almost $12,000 that had already recovered from the other driver. So $12,000 almost of duplicate benefits were awarded to this individual because of how the system currently operates. By the way, it's a result that neither the plaintiffs nor the defendants bar expected to happen. As the court noted in the Lennartson decision, leading practitioners on both the plaintiffs and the defense side specifically had commented on this potential outcome before the Lennartson decision and said that a no-fault claim would typically not exist for those same damages because it would provide a duplicate recovery. The concurring justice expressed his concerns, saying that the result here in this decision creates the opportunity for litigants to abuse the no-fault system, and that abuse in turn will drive up insurance policy premiums for those the No-Fault Act was designed to protect. That's a direct quote from the Supreme Court justice in issuing the concurring opinion. So what this act does is it says, if you go to court and you get those benefits from one source, you can't get those same benefits from a second source. That's all it does, is it gives dollar for dollar compensation of the losses. It doesn't take away from your ability to be compensated. It just makes sure you don't profit from a loss. And so we would ask that this bill be moved. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Butler. Mr. Johnson?
Mr. Chairman and committee members, Bob Johnson, Insurance Federation of Minnesota. Our members write a majority of the private passenger auto sold in the state of Minnesota. I didn't know what Ms. Butler was going to say, but she said it better than I could have said it. What I'm going to do is shorten my comments then.
Ms. Butler, thank you.
I get it. I've been around for a little bit. But Mr. Chairman and committee members, just a couple of points, kind of a little maybe higher macro points, because I suspect there will come to the table some discussion and talking about independent medical examinations. The chief author, Representative Lunan, talked a little bit about that. But what I wanted to assure the committee or update the committee, there is a bill moving in the legislature. Representative Lunan is the chief author. Senator Jensen has it in the Senate. It's moved out of the policy committee. I assumed it would be set up for next week in this committee if the chairman schedules it. But the legislative task force, which had representatives around this table, both Representative Atkins and Representative Lunan, attended a number of meetings to study the no-fault system in three particular areas of it: independent medical examinations, arbitration, and then the third one was fee schedules treatment standards. So a very laborious process with all of the interest groups around the table spending a lot of hours compiling a document, which one of the key conclusions is that there's more compiling that needs to be done to bring the data together in order to further delve into and actually reach some further conclusions. So I just wanted the committee to know that, because this arbitration issue, the independent medical examination issue, is a live wire in that sense. If that bill passes, then the task force will continue some extensive data. Calls will be made by our Commerce Department to collect information so those interest groups can sit around the table and continue the discussion. But with that, Mr. Chairman, really, this is a definitional change in the No Fault Act to restore it to really the way it had been intended from inception in 1974. That's really what this does. It's a definitional change. There's no changing of the tort thresholds. There's no changing of arbitration. All of that stands as it is in the law right today. And the legislature, the last point, has been invited actually to address this in these opinions. So we're not redoing the cases, but I think highlighting in those opinions what is coming right back to you, the legislature, to look at the wording of the statute and really inviting a legislative response. House File 3246 is an appropriate, focused response on those particular points of replacement services. And then the double recovery, as Ms. Butler said, if you read all the language in that opinion and this continual referencing of a double recovery, and that the No Fault Act was never intended to provide double recoveries. You got one $10,000 medical bill coming out of car accident and it has been fully compensated. Why should you get that same $10,000 bill paid again? And that's really where we're here today to address that, because the truth is this, lastly, is that if you pay it twice, then those costs are going to come into the system and consumers are all going to pay for those double recoveries, and it just doesn't make sense that this system do that. So, Mr. Chairman, thank you. I'd be happy to stand for any questions.
Members, any questions for Mr. Johnson or Ms. Butler? Seeing none, I think everybody's convinced. We also have Mr. Richard Harden on the list of people that wanted to come down and speak. And I'll... Mr. Carlson, welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Joel Carlson. I own a legal research and government affairs business here in St. Paul, and I represent the Minnesota Association for Justice. And our members represent policyholders who have assert and have suffered economic detriment, the types of which are the content of this bill. And I've got a couple of our members here to provide testimony for you today, Mr. Chairman, on both sections of the bill. And I agree a little bit with Representative Lunan. This is about benefits that are payable under the existing No Fault Act, which are paid without regard to fault. The difference is they won't be payable under this bill should it pass, and we think that's an injustice. And the last comment, Mr. Chair, I can always tell when the insurance industry loses one at the Supreme Court, because it always produces legislation for us to address here at the Capitol, and I'm fine with that. But this is one they lost, and they deserve to lose. They deserve to lose because they wrongly denied a claim to a consumer who had to go and collect, not first from their no-fault provider, but they had to go after they had already gone through the litigation, which is what No Fault is intended to prevent. And so I spent my summer vacation on the No Fault Task Force as well, and I've done one with Chairman Hoppe. These aren't issues that were discussed at that task force, not even mentioned. They are rare when they occur, and I think when you hear what has really gone on in these cases, you'll have a different opinion about who would benefit and who would be harmed should this bill advance. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And with that, I'm going to ask Dick Harden to go first, who's going to address Section 1 of the bill, and then Janine Jansen's going to address Section 2.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Welcome to the committee, sir. Please proceed when you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, my name is Richard Harden. I'm an attorney with an office in Woodbury. I reside in New Brighton. I want to address the primary homemaker part of this proposed legislation. And the first thing I want to do is I want to clarify eligibility, because I think prior speakers misspoke with the idea that anyone who was involved in a motor vehicle crash is eligible for primary homemaker benefits. That's not the case. Eligibility is much more limited than that. The provision that is being asked to be amended here affects only the primary homemaker. Who is the primary homemaker? Well, let's look at what the Supreme Court says. The Supreme Court said in the leading case in this area, it's called Rindall, long ago, Supreme Court said, ordinarily there is one family member who is in charge and who does most of the work in the home. It is injury to this person which most definitely results in an economic loss to the family unit. In today's Minnesota family structure, it can be all over the board, right? We can have men in charge, we can have women in charge, but the Supreme Court says, and the law as written currently says, there's going to be one person in that household who's going to be primarily responsible for the household chores. It is only injury to this person that gives rise to the primary homemaker benefit. So that's very important. Now, still, despite the diversity of Minnesota families, that mostly affects women. Still, this benefit that we're talking about eliminating or paring back affects mostly women. What is it? It is the reasonable value of those household chores that they provide to their family unit, whether they have children, whether they're single or not. Somebody not scrubbing those toilets, somebody not doing the laundry that's piling up next to the wash machine, somebody who's not doing the dishes that are overflowing in the sink has been hurt in the car crash. Those services have economic value. That's what the Supreme Court says. Most definitely, those services that they're unable to perform due to their car crash injuries have real, tangible economic value. This proposal would seek to eliminate that. Now, let's talk about numbers. Again, it's not anybody who's injured in a car crash that's eligible for this benefit, only the primary homemaker. Let's talk about numbers. I serve both as an arbitrator and I advocate for our clients. So I'm both in a neutral role and as an advocate role. In my experience, that I've been doing this 34 years, about one in 40 cases that I see, either as an advocate or as an arbitrator, as a neutral, even raise a replacement services claim, right? Even raises it. Second, there's no benefit, if you read the law as written, there's no benefit for a primary homemaker for the first 7 days after the motor vehicle crash. What does that mean? That means only the most seriously injured Minnesotans qualify for the primary homemaker benefit to begin with. I want to give you an example from my caseload. Young couple, baby in the back in the car seat, driving down in their small compact car. They're a young family, they don't have a lot of money. Drunk driver crosses the center line, head-on crash. The husband, his feet went like this. He couldn't walk for months because he had fractures of both ankles and legs. His wife sitting next to him, she couldn't perform the household services. She lost a third of her intestines in the crash, and she was laid up for months. Luckily, the baby's life was saved because the crack in her vertebrae was 3 millimeters less. Otherwise, she would have been dead on the scene. That family deserved this benefit. Whether or not anybody came in to clean Mrs. Fruth's table, chairs, to do her laundry, to do her vacuuming, to cook her meals, to scrub her toilets, for that family unit, that had a real economic loss to that family, regardless of whether a friend from church, synagogue, or temple comes in and does it, whether a neighbor comes in and does it, whether a friend comes in and does it, whether a relative comes in or does it. The fact that those services are not being performed due to car crash injuries has real, tangible economic loss to that family, and that's all the current law compensates. That's all the Supreme Court said in the Schrader case. That's it. This law, respectfully, members of the committee, I do not see needs any changing. It is something that's been there since 1974 when the no-fault law was enacted in the state of Minnesota. It originally paid $15 an hour. Now the maximum benefit for the 1 in 40 to 50 people who can even claim it, who are eligible for it, pays a maximum of $200 a week. I think the law is fine as written. I think this change would hurt Minnesota primary homemakers, and primarily that's women. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Harden. Seeing no questions, Ms. Jansen?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can you hear me?
You might want to slide over just a little bit more. We can hear you, but this way the tape will pick it up, too.
Well, thank you.
Oh, and by the way, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. I've never done this before, so this is kind of exciting.
You're doing great so far.
My name is Janine Jansen. I'm with the law firm of Jansen and Palmer. I do primarily commercial insurance litigation on behalf of insureds. I am an MNAJ member, and like Ms. Butler, I was formerly on the opposite side. I was a partner at Marin Gear and represented exclusively carriers in many types of actions, but particularly no-fault actions in Minnesota's courts, including Minnesota's Supreme Court. I volunteered to assist with the amicus brief that the MNAJ filed in the Leonardson and Foss cases, because there were two cases here, not just one, because my work on the side of carriers made me very passionate about this issue. I don't currently do much in the way of personal injury law. I have a few personal injury claims, but for the most part what I do is commercial insurance. What was troubling to me about the Leonardson and Foss cases has to do with how the carriers were framing the very issue at stake. Leonardson, as you may know, involved an insured who had gone to trial, had an award of full benefits, full damages claimed for medical expenses, and then sought no-fault benefits for medical expenses, and the insurance carrier in that case, I think it was State Farm, took the position that she was precluded from making a claim for those benefits in the no-fault case because she had already been awarded that amount or that same amount in at trial against the tortfeasor. In the Foss case, on the other hand, the insured went to trial and had a partial award of medical benefits. Some of the medical expenses were not awarded, and the carrier, I believe it was also State Farm, took the position then when Foss tried to claim no fault benefits for medical expenses having not been fully reimbursed, State Farm took the position that Foss was precluded from seeking those because there had been a decision in district court that those medical expenses were not awardable and therefore not reasonable or necessary related to the accident. And it was particularly Foss that gave me great trouble, because to equate no-fault benefits with medical expenses that would be awarded in a court trial ignores the fact that these are first-party insurance benefits. They are benefits that everybody pays for and everybody has a right to claim, and we all need to be able to access those without regard to whether they would be awarded in a jury trial, because juries award damages on all sorts of bases and we never know exactly why. The second portion of this bill, I submit, is a solution in search of a problem. There has not been, in the 40 years that the Minnesota No-Fault Act has been in its current form, this part of it anyway, there has not been a huge number of people who will wait until after a trial on the merits of their tort claim to try to claim no-fault benefits. And there's a and in fact today there are 7,000 AAA arbitrations pending. These are all people who chose to seek the arbitration rather than go to district court first. The reason for that is that no-fault benefits are intended to relieve people who are suffering and need it, and they need it now. They have been provided services by medical providers, hospitals, doctors, ER doctors, all sorts of folks who need to be paid and need to be paid now, not 6 years from now when litigation against the tortfeasor has concluded. And so the vast majority of people who make a no-fault claim cannot afford to wait. It just happened that they were able to wait in this case. I submit to you as well that the premise, I believe, that the Insurance Federation is propounding here is that people will game the system and wait to make their no-fault claims in order to try to get a double recovery. Again, the vast majority of people couldn't possibly afford to do that. They need this money because they need the treatment, and they can't get the treatment if the care provider is not getting paid. So there is not a huge risk of the system being gamed, and it's not being gamed, and it hasn't been gamed for 40 years. Insurers have every incentive to pursue no-fault claims. On the other hand, if Subdivision 1A, if Section 2, I'm sorry, is passed, we will tilt the balance in favor of encouraging carriers to withhold payment. Why? Because they might never have to pay it. If it goes to trial, they're done. They're out of the equation. So sure, they can withhold, and maybe there'll be a no-fault arbitration, but maybe people won't make no-fault claims. Maybe people will stop fighting and end up only later realizing how injured they are, and then bring a tort claim and only later seek their no-fault recovery. Nothing about the Act, for example, protects someone like Foss, who was not fully compensated and who would have, under this statute, be precluded from trying to seek no-fault benefits to help sort of shore up whatever the jury opted not to award. The proposed bill really doesn't do anything. It's not likely to affect the business of how carriers do their jobs, other than to encourage denials. But it has no effect on the insured's behavior, because insureds will not game the system because they have no incentive to, because they need prompt payment. And so bringing a no-fault arbitration is the solution there. I'm just checking my notes. I think the effect of the bill would be to encourage denials and delay, and to push more claims into district court than should be there. The effect in the Leonardson case was solely to prevent the carrier from benefiting from the delay. The carrier in Leonardson, recall, denied the benefits, and it then wanted to benefit from the delay. Nothing stops the carrier there from arguing that the no-fault benefits should not be awarded in a no-fault arbitration. Nothing. They can go to the no-fault arbitration, argue all the same standards that they always had, and they may win and they may lose. The only thing that Leonardson stopped them from doing was arguing, you can't get these, you're precluded from it, we'll never hear it. It's a false, and I guess the last thing I'll get to is just something, and this is why I felt so moved to volunteer to work on the amicus brief in Leonardson, even though this really isn't an issue that I face much in my own practice today. It is a false equation to equate benefits awardable under a first-party insurance program like no-fault with third-party awards that would then be recoverable from a liability carrier. They are nothing like one another, any more than the benefits that we all enjoy with our homes. If our house burns to the ground, whether we are owed the value of our home has nothing to do with whether that same value would be awarded in a court trial against the person who caused it to be burned to the ground. They are two totally different things. And to equate the two is grossly unfair to insureds. And I say this again as somebody who has been, has been on the other side and I was a partner at Marin Gear. I loved my work and I respect carriers. But the causation rules in first party insurance and third party liability coverage are totally different in Minnesota, and they should be. And it would be a travesty, I think, to allow no-fault carriers to benefit from a delay in payment in the way that this statute would, or this proposed statute would allow them to do so.
Thank you, Ms. Jansen. You did a very nice job. Questions, members?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. We appreciate the indulgence of the committee. I mean, I really want to emphasize that this Section 2 really does turn no-fault on its head. And one of the critical public policies of no-fault was prompt payment. And when you take away that incentive, this is going to have a significant impact on the courts, on providers, and on your constituents. And we'd hope that that this bill is examined in that way as well if it does move forward. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Representative Atkins has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was looking, I guess this is for Representative Lunan. The part I'm not seeing in your bill is where the, how much the premiums will go down.
Representative Lunan.
That's a great question, Representative. Thank you, Chairman. The there is no provision in here as far as the premiums. The testifier is right that the second part of this bill, as far as I know of, there's only been one occurrence of it. It was very recently. The first testifier commented about this wasn't mentioned in the No-Fault Reform Task Force. That ruling came down right, I think it was actually 2 days before our very last meeting as the task force. Would have been one of the reasons that it didn't get brought up officially. We already had an agenda. Certainly it was being talked about during the breaks. But it has only occurred once. And so I follow where you're going with this, Representative. And I want to comment that the comments about how this will increase insurance companies' denial of claims, there is a lot of problems with no-fault coverage in Minnesota. The IME process I consider flawed. I'm going to present legislature this year yet to try to correct some of that. We need treatment standards to bring in some of the outliers, which will reduce the need for some of these IMEs. And so I agree there's issues out there, and this bill is basically righting a wrong that you can't collect twice for something. And also, it doesn't do anything to prevent the primary homemaker from paying for those services to get them done. Nothing in this bill does that. It just says that you're going to have to incur that cost to do it. And the allowing the dishes to get dirty, the house to get messy or whatever, that actually is a choice because the revenue is there provided by the coverage to go ahead and have that hired and take care of it.
Thank you, Representative Lunan. Representative Atkins?
Quick follow-up, Mr. Chairman. Representative Lunan, how much will premiums go down?
Well, that's all. Premiums are all based on actuaries. You'd have to ask the Commerce Department to come up for that, but they're the ones that go ahead and handle the ratings on that. I don't know if this will affect premiums at all. It should. If losses go down, premiums should go down, though.
Representative Atkins?
I'll take him up on his suggestion.
Representative Dean?
No. I mean, oh, sorry. I was hoping somebody from Commerce could tell me how much premiums would go down.
Mr. Brickwitty?
Is he a deputy commissioner yet?
Assistant commissioner. Assistant. So he'll know answers like this?
And Representative Luna, if you want to have Ms. Butler come back up, you should stay up there too.
We need a second row of chairs here.
That's okay. We're thinking of adding on anyhow. Mr. Brickwitty.
Mr. Chairman, Peter Brickwitty, Assistant Commissioner from the Department of Commerce. I came to Commerce and wasn't expecting the Civil Law Committee to break out. But Representative Atkins, not being an actuary, I don't think I'm the best staff person at the Department of Commerce to tell you the answer to that question, but I don't know if it is a knowable answer necessarily. I think Representative Lunan's answer of we don't know exactly would probably be the best bet that I could give you at this time.
Representative Atkins, there you have it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To Representative Lunan's point, how many times have we encountered this situation since 1974?
Representative Lunan.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, as far as I know, there was just one ruling recently. But it's just like a leaking roof. As soon as I see that first wet spot, I'm going to get up there and I'm going to fix it. And that's what this bill does.
So you're a carpenter in addition to being a Commerce Commissioner? We like that. Thank you, Representative Lunan. Representative Atkins.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lunan, how many no-fault claims have there been since 1974?
Pardon me?
We've had one time where this has arisen. How many no-fault claims have there been since 1974, even ballpark?
Representative Lunan.
Ballpark would be a lot. I don't have a number.
Mr. Chairman,
is we want to get Mr. Brickwee back here.
We're talking about a major change to no-fault. This is kind of a basic question. It's one claim out of how many? I mean, is there somebody that's aware?
Ms. Butler or
Carlson,
Mr. Carlson,
you know, or Mr. Ms. Butler?
Mr. Chairman and members, on average, according to the Department of Public Safety's annual report on automobile crashes, there are somewhere around 35,000 to 38,000 Minnesotans that actually receive injuries in automobile accidents every year. And so maybe some of them may not have no-fault coverage, but let's assume that most of them do. So you're talking about a range of, since 1974, somewhere in excess of 30,000 a year that have had no-fault claims. And the system works because there is not an incentive to deny claims. And if you change the law the way this bill is written, there is an incentive to deny the claim because these aren't claims, Mr. Chair, members, just let's be clear. These aren't claims that are double recovered. I was entitled to that policy benefit. You owed it to me. I paid a premium for it. You didn't pay it when it was due, and I had to go and litigate with someone else. Now I'm entitled to get what I paid for under my policy. That's really what this is about. And this takes away the incentive for the insurer to pay.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Ms. Butler, did you want to weigh in on this?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Atkins, in order to address both of your concerns, really with regard to the premiums as well as to your concern about how often this arises, I think to address the latter first, the reason that it hasn't arisen on a regular basis is because all of the practitioners, as I alluded to in my earlier testimony, assume that this wasn't the right way to go about things. It's exactly what the court in the concurrence noted in Leonardson, which is that the whole purpose of no-fault is to do the arbitration first and then come to court. And because most of the practitioners were following what the purpose of the No-Fault Act was, what everyone assumed to be the right way of going about it, that's why you don't see this come up. Now that it has come up, what the court has actually said about incentives are that, and this is from the court, not from the Insurance Federation, not from the defense bar, it's that incentives matter. And what today's ruling in the Leonardson decision does is it creates incentives that are inconsistent with the legislator's intent, that it will result in more cases being pursued in district court first because the benefit is an additional $12,000 in that plaintiff's pocket at the end of the day that is a double recovery, a double payment of medical expenses. So it does create adverse incentives if this law doesn't pass. The same thing is true with regard to the policy premiums. The law might not make premiums go down, but it will, as what the concurring justice said, is that it might help prevent them from going up, from increasing.
Mr. Chairman, is this being counted against my time?
Because all I asked was how many no-fault claims there have been.
Representative Atkins, your time is done.
Clearly.
Actually, Mr. Carlson used up your time.
Yeah.
We're just trying to get to the bottom of things here. Representative Atkins.
And those, Mr. Chairman, I appreciate it. Ms. Butler, I appreciate your comments. Those are my simple questions. Okay, so here's my hard questions. And I thought that in total would take 30 seconds to get my basic questions answered. So my understanding then is point 0.00068% of the time this has arisen in the last 42 years, and we're talking about changing Minnesota law based on that. Based on what Ms. Butler just said, is it fair then to assume that the typical practitioner, in order to secure this extra potential funds, would wait? Typically, you'd agree with me. Tell me if you don't. It takes a year to a year and a half before you get an error report from a physician, the treating doctor. The claim is then presented to the insurance company for them to review, evaluate, make an offer. Eventually, you start talking settlement. You're at the year and a half to year and 8 month mark. If there's no resolution, and you're proposing that there shouldn't be a resolution because you're saying that these practitioners will want to go to trial in order to maximize the recovery for their clients. So now they're going to go to court. Average time takes 14 months. So we're now a year and 6 months plus another 14 months. What are we at, the three-year, a little over three-year mark before we get to trial? Then we got to win, right? So we're going to be, you know, we're about three and a half years out. That the typical person is going to want to, there's an incentive now to wait 3.5 years while your outstanding medical bills are hanging over your head. You've got $12,000 or $15,000 or $20,000. Regents Hospital is banging on your door to get paid. Your treating doctor is banging on your client to get paid. You're saying that the typical lawyer and client are now incentivized to wait 3.5 years so that they can recover in that claim against the other driver, and then pursue the no-fault claim. They're going to do that? Is that what you're suggesting is going to be the incentivized now? That's going to be what people are going to do?
Representative Lunen or Ms. Butler?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Atkins. That may not be the typical response, but we certainly want to prevent it from becoming a typical response. And the fact of the matter is that no-fault isn't the only pocket of money that can compensate these medical bills. As a practitioner on both sides, we see many chiropractors, other providers willing to forego payment for a while and continue treating until there's a recovery. But you also have, and especially under the Affordable Care Act, you now have required health insurance benefits that might also help alleviate or create an opportunity for people who might not otherwise be able to afford waiting to take advantage of this double recovery system to now do so. And again, that's the only purpose here. It's to guide them back to what the whole purpose of the No-Fault Act was intended to do. Address it as should be promptly through the arbitration system and then to pursue any additional benefits in the court.
So under the proposal, Mr. Chairman, there's actually the counter incentive. If we pass this bill, you've now incentivized the insurance company to cut people off of their care so that they may not ever have to pay. You force them to go off to trial against the at-fault driver. If they recover there, you don't ever have to pay. So State Farm might not ever have to pay a claim again. They'd be incentivized to cut everybody else off. I'd move to delete Section 1, Mr. Chairman, and I would ask for a roll call, and I have a question about that as well.
Representative Atkins would like to remove Section 1 from the bill, and he's got a question about that.
Representative Chairman, Representative Lunen, what percentage of homemakers are women?
Representative Lunen?
I have no idea.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lunen, if I were to cite the U.S. Census and it said 97% of primary homemakers were women, would you have any reason to argue with that? I just looked it up on the interweb, which does work down here in spite of our phone service not working.
Well, I'm not going to automatically believe you, but I can't argue with it.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, Section 1 is the primary homemaker provision, and that what this does is it targets homemakers, and it targets primarily women. It's an unfair provision that takes away a benefit that is currently available under Minnesota law that people have paid for. Literally, I was just talking with my insurance agent today. We pay thousands of dollars a year for automobile coverage, and you're now looking to take a benefit away that folks pay thousands of dollars for, and that's primarily to the benefit of women. I think that's unfair, and I've moved that section be deleted, Mr. Chairman. I believe I asked for a roll call.
You did ask for a roll call, Representative Atkins. Representative Lunen, do you want to address Representative Atkins' request to have Section 1 removed?
Well, first of all, it doesn't remove the benefit. What it does is it clarifies what the law originally intended, is that you now have the revenue available to go ahead and take care of those domestic costs or whatever they are, but it's an indemnity coverage. You have to incur it. And that has simply since then morphed into something where it becomes a potential profit center. Actually, this bill would encourage that domestic care because it's kind of a use it or lose it to that aspect also, that it behooves the injured household, and I'll go with household on this, to bring someone in to take care of those services simply because there's no reason not to.
Thank you, Representative Lunin. Representative
Mr. Harden, actually, if I could.
Sure, Representative Atkins.
Mr. Harden, are you available? I'll share the question. Maybe you can listen as you're coming down so that we save a little bit of time. You serve as an arbitrator frequently. You've had these claims before you. You've handled cases where you've got primary homemaker claims. You heard my census data, but I'm wondering if that squares with real life here in Minnesota. Are most of these claims brought on behalf of women?
Yes, sir.
Mr. Harden.
They are.
And a follow-up, Mr. Chairman, for Mr. Harden.
Representative Atkins.
I said most. That could be 51% of the time. Would you put a percentage of how
many?
I think
90 to 95% range. The 97 might be a little steep, but certainly over 90.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Harden. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Atkins. We've heard from Representative Atkins and Representative Loon. With that, roll call having been requested on the Atkins motion, the clerk will take the roll.
Chair Hoppe.
No.
Representative O'Driscoll.
No.
Representative Anderson.
No.
Representative Applebaum.
Yes.
Representative Atkins.
Yes.
Representative Dean.
Yes.
Representative Halverson.
Yes.
Representative Johnson Sheldon.
Yes.
Representative Kreisha is not here. Representative Loon.
No.
Representative Loonin.
No.
Representative Scott.
No.
Representative Smith?
No.
And Swidzinski.
And
Representative
Swidzinski.
No.
And
Representative Sundin.
Yes.
Representative Tice.
No.
By a vote of 6-10, the motion does not prevail. Back to the bill. Representative Atkins, I think you still have the floor.
I just had another motion.
Representative Atkins.
We acknowledge that this is a cut in benefits, therefore there ought to be some reduction in premiums, and I'd move that the bill be amended to require that there be a minimum of 1% reduction in premiums. And ask for a roll call.
Representative Atkins, do you want to... I don't think that needs a lot of explanation, but
no,
Representative Loonin.
Mr. Chairman, it seems to me quite simple. If you're going to take a benefit away from this primary homemaker benefit away from all of the folks who pay for it in Minnesota, there at least ought to be, and I'll look to amend it on the floor to the real percent. There's got to be some amount that if you're taking a benefit away, maybe it's 10%, maybe it's 50, but I'll say for today that it at least ought to be 1%, and then when we get to the floor, we'll fill in the actual number. How's that sound? Is that something that you consider friendly, Representative Loonin?
Representative Loonin.
I withdraw my vote.
The current insurance statute states that insurance premiums have to be adequate, cannot be excessive, and cannot discriminate. And I leave that with, and I actually share your concern that the relationship between the premiums people pay and the risk that they represent, I share your discomfort on that. But that's the mechanics that's in place, and that's the way this should be played. So I would not support that.
Thank you, Representative Loonin. Representative Atkins moves to amend House File 3246 and has requested a roll call. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Hoppe.
No.
Representative O'Driscoll.
No.
Representative Sarah Anderson.
No.
Representative Applebaum.
Yes.
Representative Atkins.
Yes.
Representative Dean.
Yes.
Representative Halverson.
Yes.
Representative Sheldon Johnson.
Yes.
Representative Loon. Representative Loonin.
No.
Representative Scott.
Nope.
Representative Smith.
No.
Representative Sundin.
Yes.
Representative Swidzinski.
No.
Representative Tease.
No.
Representative Kreisha.
No.
By a vote of 6-10, the motion does not prevail. Back to the bill. Representative Atkins, you still have the floor.
Well, Mr. Chairman, what we've just said, and I'll say my little bit of my piece here, and then is that we're not We're not even willing to say that we're going to reduce premiums by 1%, and yet we're taking away the primary homemaker benefit in Minnesota no-fault law. Seems kind of unfair. Seems inappropriate. It's wrong. We shouldn't be voting for it. Over a couple of cases that the insurance industry didn't happen to like the outcome, so they came hustling over here to the legislature to make changes to something that applies 0.00068% of the time on the one piece and applies 97% of time to women on section one. Just blatantly unfair and wrong. And I'd recommend a no vote. I'd ask for a roll call on the bill.
There will be a roll call. Thank you, Representative Atkins. Representative Sundin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just find it remarkable that we're talking about policy that surrounds some numbers here that are fairly insignificant by today's standards. I don't know if that $200 per week was in place back in 1974. Maybe that was an adequate number back then to pay a woman to care for you or care for your house when you were injured. Being an injured person and watching my wife work and maintain the house while I was injured, she was grossly underpaid. And to address this bill without repairing that number and getting rid of that first week exclusion is an embarrassment to people that care for people that have been involved in accidents. Thank you.
Representative Sundin. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't know, Representative Loon, you're probably not the right person to ask this question, or maybe Ms. Butler. But kind of taking off of what Representative Atkins said, I'm just interested, because this is a recent change in the court ruling, if we went back to 1974, I think was the year it was mentioned that this was put in place, and if we doubled the claims on every one of the accidents that happened here in the state of Minnesota, what kind of an increase in insurance premiums would all the women and men in Minnesota face today?
Representative Loonan?
Well, again, that's not a question I can answer. And as far as the high percentage of women, I think when you do investigate this, Representative Atkins, you're going to find that there's actually quite an occurrence on people who live alone that are doing this. And so it isn't necessarily female. I think you're going to find that I remember seeing some data on that when I was looking at this. And it would have effect in premium. Again, I share the concern that premium should represent the risk that is charged. And there's a couple different mechanisms in place for that. And Representative Sundin's comment about the cap on coverage, I actually agree with that too. And there's been attempts before to apply an inflationary algorithm to all of the coverages and the tort threshold to apply that in and to make sure that is current and is adequate.
Thank you, Representative Loonan. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and maybe Ms. Butler. I would assume that if this was in place from 1974, we would see a different insurance premium perspective. Can you confirm that or not? Would it be higher right now today if this was in place going back to 1974?
Ms. Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson. I think that's exactly the case. At least that's what the court's concern, the concurring opinion was in the Leonardson, is that once you start to undermine what the intended purposes of the No-Fault Act was, once you start to allow double recoveries and benefits for things that are not performed, as in the case of replacement services, that the natural effect of that is to increase premiums. So if that had been the case since 1974, I think that the natural conclusion of that is that premiums would be substantially higher today. And certainly that's the concern expressed by the court.
Representative Anderson, thank you. Thank you, Ms. Butler. Representative Sundin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the author. Can we expect by the time this hits the floor that under 1.16, the maximum of $500 per week will be entered into this bill and then strike anything after the period after a week on 1.17?
Careful, Representative Sundin. You could wind up being a co-author here. Representative Loonan, to that point.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Sundin, the intent of this bill is twofold and pretty straightforward. First of all, a person should only collect a loss incurred, an expense incurred. An insurance contract is not an opportunity to profit. The second part of it is that you cannot collect for a loss you no longer have. In other words, you cannot double dip. And so that provision wouldn't be in there.
Thank you, Representative Lunan. Members, any other questions? Anybody else? We've had a lot of testimony on this bill for and against. Anybody else in the audience that feels like weighing in? Welcome to the committee, sir. Welcome back to the committee. Please state your name for the record and start when you're ready.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Kevin Goodnow, and I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Chiropractic Association. And we do have concerns about Section 2 of the bill. And it's portrayed in a way that you can collect once and then you're not able, and then we want to preclude double dipping. But the other concern is, from a chiropractor's perspective or a provider's perspective, is they provide a bill. They may have a client or a patient come in. They don't know it's an automobile accident right away. The patient doesn't tell them. They submit the claims to the regular health insurer. If that claim is processed and sent out, they find out later that it's a no-fault insurer claim. They should be able to send it back to the insurer, and they settle up with health insurer and pay back the health insurer. So what happens is, a lot of times under the regular health plan, for an individual, they have co-pays, they have deductibles. And the way we're reading this bill is, if somebody even submits it by accident, they can't settle up and correct that mistake and go back after the no-fault insurer.
Thank you, Mr. Goodnow. Members, any questions? Thank you. Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just acknowledging all of the discussion about civil law issues. It's been one reference after another to Supreme Court decisions in the civil law. Granted, we get into civil law in here and we like it, but in deference to the Civil Law Committee, I'd move that the bill go to the Civil Law Committee.
Representative Atkins, we did. The original motion was to have it go right to the General Register because of the chapter it's in, but I think given the discussion we've had, I think that's probably the wise thing to do. And we could consult with the chair here, but I think that would give the parties a chance to talk about this one more stop before it gets to the floor. And I would support that idea. Representative Dean, any other questions, members? Seeing none, Representative Lunan, we will give you the final word.
Mr. Chairman, members, this bill does two things. It only allows a person to collect for a loss they incurred. And if they choose to not evoke a service and pay for a service to clean their house, that is a choice that was made. That was not... i.e. an intentional act. The second part is only allows you to collect once for a loss. Anyone in here would know, out of just fairness and common sense, that you cannot collect twice for the same claim. Mr. Goodnow testified that it would, even if you submitted something accidentally, this bill is very specific in that if you collect once, you cannot collect again. So this bill is right where it should be, and I would appreciate a green vote.
Thank you, Representative Lunan. Roll call having been requested, Representative Lunan will renew his motion that House File 3246, after being heavily discussed, easy for me to say, be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law. And with that, the clerk will take the roll.
Chair Hoppe.
Aye.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Aye.
Representative Sarah Anderson.
Aye.
Representative Applebaum.
No.
Representative Atkins.
No.
Representative Dean.
No.
Representative Helverson.
No.
Representative Sheldon Johnson.
No.
Representative Kreisha.
Aye.
Representative Loon.
Aye.
Representative Lunan.
Yes.
Representative Scott.
Yes.
Representative Sundin.
No.
Representative Swadzinski.
Yes.
Representative Tice.
Yes.
By a vote of 10-6, the motion passes and the bill is re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law. Thank you, members. Thank you, Representative Lunan. Thank you, all the testifiers, for a good discussion. Members, that took so long, I think we're just going to skip the next bill. Wasn't that important anyhow? And move right on. Oh, sorry, Representative O'Driscoll. All right, we'll do yours. Representative O'Driscoll, as he's walking up, he will move House File 2991 so that it is properly before the committee. Representative O'Driscoll. I also see that we have a A16 amendment. Is that an author's amendment, or is that something else?
Mr. Chair, thank you. Yes, that is the A16 is an author's amendment, and it's a version of a delete all that just cleans up some language, and we'll have a chance to visit about it today. So, Mr. Chair, I move the A16 to be able to get the bill in the shape that I would like it for today's discussion.
Representative O'Driscoll moves the A16 amendment. Any discussion of that? Seeing none, those in favor of the adoption of the A16 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, same sign. The motion is adopted. The A16 has been adopted. Representative O'Driscoll, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the Commerce Committee. A couple of things for you. The appraisers in the state of Minnesota have an association that works to help improve the professionalism of the industry, and they're bringing forward to us today a bill that provides some of that clarification and increased professionalism that they would like to have codified in state law. And so I have Mr. Byron Miller, who will be speaking to the majority of the bill that working group has put together, and then there's also another provision in section one that I will take and talk about that is in this bill as well. So, Mr. Chair, the gentleman to my right is Mr. Byron Miller, and I'd like to have him summarize the bill for the committee if I could.
Mr. Miller, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Byron Miller, and I am the chair of the Government Relations Committee for the North Star chapter.
Mr. Chair, for those who know appraisal language, I asked him to do the short form appraisal instead of the long form narrative appraisal with his testimony today.
Representative O'Driscoll, thank you. That's always appropriate.
I'll try. Byron Miller, chair of the Government Relations Committee, North Star chapter of the Appraisal Institute. And our bill has three components. Representative O'Driscoll is going to be talking about the section one, which is the first component, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I'm going to talk about the other two. I'll summarize them for you. The first one is we're making a change to statute 82C, which is the appraisal management company, its definition. There is an existing law in place, and really what we're doing is an administrative change to that, cleaning up some language and making some clarifications so that we had a situation where there was some miscommunications with DOC, and we're seeking to clarify that. All right, moving right along. The second portion of that is, or the third actually, is the customary and reasonable fees. I believe in Dodd-Frank indicated that appraisers should be paid a customary and reasonable fee. Unfortunately, they did not give the state in regulatory institutions the ability to the team to regulate it. So really this is kind of an administrative change as well that gives the Department of Commerce the authority to enforce the Dodd-Frank provision of the customary and reasonable fees. How was that for summary?
That's the shortest short form appraisal I've seen in a long time, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Miller, that was nice. Thank you. Representative O'Driscoll, do you want to, do you have somebody else that wants to testify right now, or do you want, why don't we do that? Why don't we have whoever you want to testify,
and then we can talk about section one of the bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Great. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Scott DiBiasio. I'm the Manager of State and Industry Affairs with the Appraisal Institute. I just wanted to add that the bill that you have in front of you is the product of a collaborative effort amongst all of the affected stakeholders, the appraisers through the Appraisal Institute, the Department of Commerce, and the AMCs themselves through their trade association. So this is a collaborative bill. With the exception of Section 1, everyone is in concurrence with the remaining sections.
Mr. DiBiasio?
That's correct.
Thank you. I was going to mention that because I know that this was at least a little bit contentious earlier. In this committee, we always like collaborative efforts and peace in the valley. And so to all of you and Mr. Brickwitty, the Department of Commerce, everybody that worked on this, thank you. I know you a lot of work went into it, so we do appreciate that. Sir, if you want to... You certainly don't need to testify, but you're more than welcome to.
I guess I'll let it go. Keep it short.
Mr. Brickwitty, if you want to...
Mr. Chairman, again, Peter Brickwitty from the Commerce Department, and I want to echo many of the comments that have been expressed here. I think sections 2, 3, and 4 reflect very hard work on the part of the appraisers, the AMCs, and we had a very productive conversation at the Commerce Department office two Fridays ago involving a number of parties, including former House member Ray Vandeveer, who was part of that conversation. So very happy to have engaged in that conversation. I think we're almost there on this bill. I think the department has concerns about Section 1 and its inclusion, which will have a fiscal impact on the agency. Happy to get into the details there, but I think sections 2, 3, 4, 5 completely worked out. Section 1 we still have an issue with here at the department as it expands an exemption under Minnesota law that we fundamentally have a problem with to begin with. So members, hoping to continue to work on Section 1 of the bill as it moves forward, and hopefully we'll be able to resolve that fiscal issue as it moves forward.
Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Brickwitty, the fiscal impact would only arise if you pursued investigations that did not yield results, findings. Is that correct? If all of your investigations were successful and found something, you could still charge for that. It would just be if you pursued an investigation that found no merit for the investigation.
Mr. Brickwitty.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Atkins, thanks for that question. I think what the inclusion in Section 1 does, somewhat ironically, is I think limits the Department of Commerce's ability to informally dispose of situations that are legitimate complaints to the department, require investigation and analysis, but ultimately do not result in a formal sanction against the license holder. What this will do is, if that option to the agency is eliminated, is drive more formal actions against license holders. So in many cases, it is to both, there's a good public policy outcome from the department's perspective, and there is a good outcome for the license holder's standpoint in informally resolving the issue, either through a consent order or an informal warning. In that sense, there is a modification in the behavior that was was the origin of the complaint to the department, and there's also no, in many cases, action taken against the license or any report of any action taken against the license. In the appraiser world, over the last 3 years, the Commerce Department has opened a number of files, several hundred, I think just under 1,000. We have only billed for less than, I think, 20% of the total number of cases that were opened. Of that less than 20%, the vast majority are billings for actions that result in a formal action on the part of the department. A smaller number of those are for situations where we have received a legitimate complaint, looked into it, there is work performed by the department. It does not ultimately end up with a formal action taken against the licensee. It is informally disposed of, but there is work performed by the Commerce Department in looking into that complaint.
Thank you, Mr. Brickwitty. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I look forward to the parties continuing to work on Section 1.
Representative Atkins, I would echo that. I think it is important to keep working on this, and Mr. Brickwitty, whatever the percentage is, if we have people that are being accused and it winds up that there's no wrongdoing, I mean, through no fault of their own, and they're winding up having to pay, I think that's a pretty tough row to hoe.
And Mr. Chairman, I appreciate that, and generally speaking, I agree with that comment. I guess my point is that there are legitimate complaints that come to the department and require investigation. If we spend 3 months on a case, that takes up a significant proportion of our enforcement division's time and energy, and it is possible that an individual could be billed for that time, regardless of whether or not there is a formal action taken against the licensee. Again, my point being that that is a tool that the department has to informally resolve that dispute, which again results in a good public policy outcome for consumers and also results in a good outcome for the license holder.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Well, Mr. Chair, I said I was going to speak to that, but you and Representative Atkins have done a nice job of backgrounding, and I just want to draw members' attention to lines 2.8 through 2.10, and this is the part that's in contention. Just let me read it to you and just digest it, and then I'm going to ask you to ask yourself if this is something that you think that we should have here in Minnesota statute. It says a natural person, so that'd be somebody who has an insurance license. That's what 60K represents. 82 is the real estate insurance licensing statute, and 82B is the appraisers. So natural person, so live breathing human being who's licensed under the Department of Commerce in those regulated industries. Or entities, so it'll be the brokerage, the insurance company, is what we're looking to add in there. So right now, a natural person could not be charged for investigatory costs where there was no findings. That's nice language for there wasn't any wrongdoing that could be discerned from the evidence in the investigation. So what the Commerce Department is currently doing is they're saying, well, we can't do it to a natural person. We'll just turn around and hit Atkins Realty with a fine on that, or the Hoppy Insurance Company, or whoever the case may be. And my question is, if someone called the police department or the state patrol, or there was another agency in the state of Minnesota that was doing an investigation, would we tolerate them going back to those folks and saying, well, because somebody filed a complaint, we want you to pay for our investigation costs on it? I think it comes to an issue of fairness and equity and, innocent until proven guilty, except we can send you a bill because we found you to be innocent in that situation.
Thank you, Representative O'Driscoll. Mr. Egger?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Paul Egger, Vice President of Governmental Affairs for the Minnesota Realtors, representing the 17,000 plus realtors throughout the state of Minnesota. I guess, Mr. Chair, I'm going to apologize because I'm the reason you don't have peace in the valley on this particular section, or at least part of the reason. But when the when we saw Representative O'Driscoll's and Senator Jensen's bill that they introduced for the appraisers, it did have Section 1 in the bill, which simply added 82B to the existing licensees, which Representative O'Driscoll just cited, that have this language that say, again, and thank you, Representative Atkins, for asking the question, if there's a finding of no violation. And so when we saw that language, we saw it as an opportunity to have this discussion about the fairness of not charging the natural person, as Representative O'Driscoll said, the living human being, but turning around in those same situations where there's a finding of no violation, and being able to charge the business entity, whether that's the individual, in the case that, or in the example that Representative O'Driscoll just stated, you might have the individual, the person, who's a licensed real estate broker for purposes of our organization, and they may be a very small operation where the broker is also the business entity. And so you can have a situation where it's possible that the department's prevented from charging for a finding of no violation, the investigation costs to that individual, but can turn around and bill the same individual basically as their company. And we brought this issue forward. We did share it with the department, and we understand they're opposed, but we still felt this was an important discussion. This just fundamentally does not feel appropriate. And the language in statute, I was not around when that was enacted, but I can tell you that my colleagues that were around, they did not believe that was the intent of this, is to allow the charging for investigation costs. The department may feel differently, but for the purposes of this amendment, this we feel clarifies and clearly states what should be the intent of the statute.
Thank you, Mr. Egger. Mr. Brickwood?
Mr. Chairman, just a couple of points, and again, I don't want to distract in any way from the very good work that was done on the vast majority of this bill, which does reflect a good compromise. And Representative Driscoll, to your point, I can't imagine that Atkins Real Estate or Hoppy Insurance Company would be engaged in any sort of activity that anyone would ever want to complain about. But Mr. Chairman, I think, again, the point is well taken, but I think that in practice this is not a power that has been in any way, shape, or form abused by the Commerce Department. Mr. Egger and I have had discussions, and I do appreciate him giving us advance notice that he was working on this. In the real estate world, we have one case of a situation where a business entity, which was not a sole proprietorship, where you was not a broker who is in fact the only agent in that brokerage, where there was a complaint that involved a business practice that resulted in a billing. That was a complaint against the business, not against any of the individual agents or brokers in that business. And also on the appraiser side, again, I'm aware of one complaint. about an investigation that was undertaken and a bill that was received. I think that particularly with regard to the appraisal industry, you do have individuals who are working in potentially very high emotion situations. And we had a significant discussion about this during the conversation at the Commerce Department, where you may have an appraiser working in a situation, say, on a divorce proceeding where there is a high emotion and there could be a complaint that is issued on one of the on the appraiser's work by one of the parties involved. The Commerce Department works through those complaints. Again, I think we've had just under 1,000 over the last 3 years in the appraisal industry, and are able to very quickly triage complaints that are frivolous, complaints that have no merit, and complaints that require further investigation. And so again, I just would stress to members that this is not an area where, again, we feel like this has been abused, and it is an area that is allowed in under current law and would have if it were removed with a further expansion of the exemptions under current law, would have a fiscal impact on the agency. Mr. Chair.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I feel like deja vu all over again, because it seemed the last bill we were talking about one claim. And I guess I'm curious, is value meeting in the Commerce Committee, is one claim going to create a bill or changes to a bill that we're going to have to deal with every time? Because it sort of seems that's the case. And my concern would be that, you know, we can spend a lot of time dealing with these single one-up cases and changing our statutes and changing our laws. And I'm not so sure that that's really a good use of our time here at the Capitol. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Dean. Any other questions for the author or the witnesses? Representative O'Driscoll.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Then I will wrap. And members, I just want to let you know as well, I'm very familiar with Chapter 82 here in the state of Minnesota. And just to close, Chapter 82.73, Subdivision 3, charges the broker with the responsibilities of supervising the salespeople that are in their charge as well as employees. And it seems to me to be a little bit odd that when you've done your statutory duty as a broker, that you can be sent a bill for doing your job. With that, Mr. Chair, I ask members to vote yes today.
So, Representative O'Driscoll renews his motion that House File 2991, as amended, be sent to the General Register. Any further discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
Motion prevails. Item next, Representative. Representative Hoppe moves House File 3211, and the motion would be to State Government Finance. Are there any amendments on this one? Okay, welcome to your committee, Chair Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and I appreciate your indulgence in hearing this. I know things have gone a little long today, but we'll try to get through this quickly. With that, I will turn it over to the experts.
Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Mr. Chairman, Tom DePasquale, Executive Director of the Minnesota Racing Commission, and I have with me Joe Skurdo, Deputy Director of the Minnesota Racing Commission.
Welcome to the committee, sir.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee and staff, thank you for hearing 3211 today. Let me give a little bit of context, which I think will be familiar to the people on this committee, because we came through with our bill last year, which you supported, and then I'll describe the bill and the policy reasons that underlie it. Last year, we appeared before the committee and described what I referred to as a structural budget deficit at the Racing Commission. We get our operating revenue almost entirely from licensing fees, and those fees have really fallen disproportionately over the years on our racetracks. The tracks pay a statutory license fee in excess of $300,000 apiece, and the 5,000 or so individual licensees that we license each year afford us another $200,000 or so in revenue. So we've got about $800,000 in operating revenue, which is really flatlined over the years, and there really isn't a prospect for those fees to increase in the near term. Our costs, meanwhile, are approaching $900,000 or $1 million, And so through your good offices and that of the legislature, we were given a general appropriation last year of $341,000 to tide us over for this biennium. But there is no free lunch. We were asked to report back by November of last year on how we would work in consultation with the racing industry to propose permanent dedicated funding changes to fully support the operations of the commission to ensure that racing is conducted in the public interest. We did so, and I want to thank members of the industry, the racetracks, horsemen and women, breeders and owners who are here today in support of the bill and really participated in good faith and very collaboratively and transparently with us at the commission to formulate a bill that we think has broad support of the entire industry and ultimately does good for the entire industry. When we reported to you in November, we described the guiding principles for fashioning sustainable funding for the commission. First, we have to have a secure and dedicated funding source to ensure proper regulatory oversight and alleviate the need for us to come back for general appropriations from the legislature. And secondly, industry participants should continue to fund the operations of the commission. That's the way it's been historically, and we think it should continue to be that way. The problem we have, as I said, is that 88% of our funding falls on the two racetracks. And that's a bit unfair, and it really places a damper on their ability to grow and thrive. So we came up with a beautifully elegant and fair proposal, and that is to reach out to activity that has taken place in the state of Minnesota really for the last 10 years and is widespread across the country, and that is advanced deposit wagering. Advanced deposit wagering is basically where you as a parimutuel bettor can place funds on deposit with an authorized and licensed advanced deposit wagering provider and either telephonically or by electronic communication make wagers against that account, and your winnings are credited and your losings are debited against that account. Today, advanced deposit wagering, or ADW, is the only segment of the racing industry that's growing. Of the $11 billion or so a year in parimutuel wagering, almost $4 billion of it is advanced deposit wagering. So just to give you an example of growth in this area, most of these companies that are ADW providers are hubbed in either Oregon or North Dakota. When North Dakota authorized ADW wagering about 5 years ago in year one, it was $46 million. That has grown to well over $400 million and is estimated to be $600 million next year. Oregon, which again aggregates all the ADW wagering taking place across the country, has grown to almost $4 billion per year in parimutuel wagering. So what is happening today is that people can wager at the track, where that's live on-track handle. And when you're at the track, you can wager on the live races that are taking place at the track, or you can wager on races that are being simulcast or televised to that track from all over the country. What we've seen in Minnesota is that on-track wagering on live racing, at Canterbury in particular, has increased over the years, and that's really against the trends in most states, and it's a tribute to Canterbury that they've got people to attend the races and wager on their live racing product, which is a very competitive product in the marketplace. Simulcast wagering, on the other hand, that is people going to the track and wagering on other races taking place outside the state, has gone from $60 million, roughly, at its peak to $30 million today. And the question is, where has that $30 million of wagering gone when we know that the national wagering trends have been relatively constant over that period of time? And the answer to that, at least inferentially from what we know, is that people are staying home or wagering on their tablets or phones on races across the country from remote locations and depriving not only the tracks but the Minnesota racing industry, its owners, breeders, and as well the commission of funds that we need to thrive in Minnesota. So with that, I'll just summarize briefly what this bill proposes to do. It first of all establishes licensing criteria and regulatory oversight of ADW providers. It allows us to recapture a portion of the approximate $20 million in parimutuel wagering that's taking place each year. It would provide revenues to our breeding industry and add money to our purses in Minnesota, and it would establish consumer protections to make sure that Minnesota residents, when they bet on races taking place outside the state of Minnesota, enjoy the protections. It would also afford the commission its operating revenue by providing us with 1% of all amounts wagered. This is not an unusual way of funding commissions across the country in those 34 states that do have advanced deposit wagering. And it would require these companies to be licensed and to provide periodic reports to the commission on their activity. So that's a broad outline. There's more details to the bill. You've got summaries of the bill. I see you've got the November 2015 report. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. DePasquale. Before we go into questions from members, just to get a lay of the land here, how many other folks would like to testify on behalf of this bill or with concerns thereof? I see just Mr. Lund. Why don't you come on down? Now, Mr. Skirto, did you want to testify, or are you a resource?
Resource.
You're a resource. Okay. Mr. Lund, if you could please join us. And if you could all stick around, because we will have questions from members, I'm sure. Mr. Lund, please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair of Committee. Alan Lund with Allied Charities of Minnesota. We represent the Licensed Gaming Charities in Minnesota.
Welcome to the committee, sir.
Thank you very much. We have some concerns with this bill and some questions. Currently, only site-based gambling is sanctioned by the state of Minnesota, and the charities believe in site-based gambling. This bill seems to be asking the Minnesota legislature to now sanction internet gambling and off-track betting. Last year, we had numerous discussions in regards to internet gambling, and there were issues surrounding asking permission, asking for forgiveness, but in the end, the legislature overwhelmingly decided to not venture into internet gambling. The other issue is we don't understand how this meets the constitutional test of the 1992 Rice decision by the Supreme Court denying internet gambling.
Thank you. Any questions for any of the witnesses or the author from committee members? Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess this question would be to either the bill author or Mr. DePasquale. So currently you had mentioned that the industry is doing okay in Minnesota, at least at the track. What is sort of the projections in the future if we don't pass something like this? I mean, could we find ourselves 2-3 years from now giving you or the Racing Commission another $500,000 or $1 million to keep it going? My question is this a key part of the financial viability of the commission in horse racing in the state of Minnesota moving forward?
Mr. DePasquale.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dean, let me answer your question, and then if I may respond to Mr. Lund's comments. In our November 2015 report, we did explore all the options for ongoing funding of the commission's operations, as well as a way to help the industry. We could pile more license fees on the tracks. We could take a higher percentage of takeout from the bettor. That would be counter to the trends across the country, which are really lowering takeout. If you add to takeout, you're simply discouraging people from wagering and lowering the churn, which is what actually helps the industry. We have and will impose higher license fees on racing and gaming vendors. Last year, the legislature took away the $100 ceiling on license fees, and we plan on promulgating a rule to impose higher license fees on racing and gaming vendors who are core to the integrity of racing and have the financial wherewithal to pay higher license fees than $100. Other than that, we have no good options. What we're proposing is what is done in other states and is continuing to self-contain the regulatory cost burden within the industry. We're not reaching out for slot machines or other forms of gaming. We're keeping it within the pari-mutuel industry for self-funding.
Representative Dean?
And just a follow-up, is there anything on law that prohibits me from right now going to, whether it's in other states or others, going in and doing ADW right now today from my computer at home?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dean, the Interstate Horse Racing Act, which was passed decades ago, is an exception to the Federal Wire Act and expressly carves out the legality of interstate horse race wagering on the Internet. Specifically, the law allows for a person to place a wager on the Internet on a horse race taking place outside of the state where pari-mutuel wagering is lawful in the host track state and the place from where the bettor is making the wager. So under federal law, it's legal. So if I may, I'll respond to Mr. Lund's comments as well with respect to the 1992 decision. As I think most of you know, pari-mutuel wagering was authorized by constitutional amendment in 1983, and it authorized on-track pari-mutuel wagering in Minnesota. The issue came up in 1992 and went to the Minnesota Supreme Court when the Racing Commission and the legislature approved brick-and-mortar off-track betting facilities to allow wagering on Minnesota races. In other words, the classic definition of off-track betting. It also authorized telephone account wagering at Canterbury so that people can bet from home by placing a bet through phone on live races at Canterbury. This bill does not do anything like that. This bill precludes wagering on Minnesota races and therefore precludes off-track betting on licensed racetracks in Minnesota, which is what Rice versus Connolly precluded. One more thing on the constitutional amendment. Allowing something does not create the negative inference that all else is not allowed. What the law allows is pari-mutuel wagering on racing in Minnesota as authorized by this body. And if you amend Chapter 240 the way we're proposing it be amended, it's pari-mutuel wagering authorized by the legislature.
Representative Dean? Mr. DePasquale, is there anything about wagering at a gas pump in here?
Well, Mr. Chair, we've taken our lessons over the last couple of years and watched how these bills proceed, and I think we've involved legislators and the industry and all stakeholders, and I think we've developed a bill that we believe conforms with the law, helps the industry, and allows the state to get its fair share of revenue from economic activity that we know is going on in the state.
Any other questions for members for Mr. DePasquale, Mr. Lund, or Mr. Skirto? If not, Chair Hoppe renews his motion that House File 3211 be sent to Chair Anderson, State Government Finance. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you to the witnesses and Chair Hoppe. Item next and item last, House File 3309. Bullion Product Dealers Regulated. Chair Hoppe will move the bill. Have it before us, and as we work through this, we'll figure out where it should go to. Chair Hoppe.
Mr. Chair, I would, of course, accept your judgment, but I believe we're just going to the General Register.
Okay. Members, as we go through this, if folks think it should go somewhere else, just let us know otherwise. The motion at this point is to move House File 3309 to the General Register. We have an amendment, the A2H330982 amendment. Is this the Chair's amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd like to offer the A2 amendment.
Okay, any discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. We now have House File 3309 as amended by the A2 amendment. Chair Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'd like to thank you for that strong support of the A2 amendment. And with that, I will turn it over to the experts in the interest of time.
Okay. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Yes, thank you. My name is Philip Beal. I'm Vice Chairman of the Industry Council for Tangible Assets, which is the national association that represents the For 30 years, the owners of businesses that deal in rare coins, paper money, and precious metals.
Thank you, Mr. Deal, and welcome to the committee. Members, you have his testimony before you, so if you could please summarize this testimony. And before we get into that, is there anyone else here that wishes to testify on behalf of House File 3309 as amended or with concerns thereof? One gentleman with concerns? Okay, so let's take brief testimony and then we'll go to the person that has some concerns. Okay, Mr. Deal.
Thank you. Before I get started, I wanted to introduce Gary Atkins, who's here beside me. He's been a Minnesota coin dealer for more than 30 years. He's licensed and bonded under the Minnesota Bullion Coin Dealers Act. I'm here to testify in support of House File 3309. This is the product of a year and a half of work with the Department of Commerce, our regulators. I think it's fair to say that it's very much a collaborative effort, and we have addressed a number of concerns that we have with the bill and that we believe strengthen the bill, take care of a number of issues, including ones that have to do with the ability to enforce the act and our ability to comply with the act. We have explained how our industry works, and they have also explained to us the legislative intent as they understand it. It's very rare for ICTA to get involved in state actions like we have in the case of this law. We believe that it's very clear that the market abuses that occurred that led to the enactment of this legislation are ones that demanded a response, and we support that. We want to see the bad actors out of this business because they cast a negative light on people who are very reputable in the business and have been in the business for a long time. The bill significantly improves our ability to comply with the law in several ways. First of all, the law as it's written today makes it very difficult for the industry to identify who a Minnesota consumer actually is. And if we cannot distinguish between Minnesota consumers and other consumers, it becomes very difficult to apply some very rigorous regulatory standards under the bill. And even for companies that decide that there's too much risk, and there is significant risk under this bill, because there's a $10,000 fine per violation and criminal penalties under this bill. Those companies that decide, because of all the uncertainty in this bill, that they will not do business in the state, cannot ensure themselves that they will not do business with a Minnesota consumer. They cannot identify in real time in a practical way who is a Minnesota consumer and who is not. And one of the things that we do is redefine who a Minnesota consumer is in a way that we can implement in the real time of our doing business. And the way we do that is in a very straightforward way. The way that states all over the country approach this problem with sales tax, including here in Minnesota. And that is, we define who a Minnesota consumer is based on the shipping address. And in every case, those of us who are shipping products, and these are expensive products, of course, we must have a shipping address in order to deliver a product to a retailer. So that allows us, in the course of our business, to identify those customers and comply with the law. Secondly, we raise the floor in the bill, the threshold at which dealers must register under the act. The current floor is $5,000 in sales and purchases over the course of the year. Our products are expensive. Gold today is at around $1,200, $1,300 an ounce. It's been as high over the last 5 years as $1,900 an ounce. A typical single coin that is sold, a bullion coin, sells for today about $1,300 an ounce. And a numismatic coin, which are also covered by this bill, would be multiples of that. So the sell or the purchase of a single coin, and certainly three or four coins, would subject a dealer or an individual to this act. That captures hobbyists and very small businesses that find it virtually impossible to comply with the law and incur the burden and the expense. And so we have raised that threshold to $25,000 a year. So I ask for your support. We have made multiple attempts, and I think we have made some changes that are very constructive, and so I ask for your support. Thank you. And
Mr. Chairman, apologize to the gentleman here. I was running the meeting earlier, but when it was run in a very slipshod way, not the way it is now, but we ran a little long, so I'm going to have it. And Mr. Stitchin, if you want to come up here and please list your objections to the bills. While he's coming up, I'd like to thank everybody that worked on this, Representative Hillstrom, the Attorney General, you gentlemen, all of the parties that helped get this to the point where it is. And not everyone is happy with it, as we'll hear in a minute.
So we have Mr. Atkins here, but you're a resource person today?
Yes.
Okay.
I mean, I do have some a little bit of testimony.
Okay, why don't we do that first? Is that okay, Mr. Chair? And then we'll go to Mr. Stasinski. Very brief.
Make it brief. We're about to lose the room.
Like, you support the bill. It's a cool thing. Mr. Atkins.
Yes, we definitely support the bill. And as you're probably going to hear, there seems to be a conspiracy theory out there that what we're trying to do is make it difficult for Minnesota dealers. And that's not the case at all. I'm a Minnesota dealer. I originally testified against this legislation when it was first introduced, and testified in several hearings against it. It has been introduced, it has been passed into law, and as a result of that, what we've tried to accomplish is to make it easier for Minnesota dealers to comply with the law. That was our main goal here. We're not trying to put anybody out of business or anything of that nature. So that's my main point.
Thank you, Mr. Atkins. I apologize for the time here, but please state your name and who you represent for the record, please,
my
sir.
Name is Tom Stachinski. I don't know if this is in order or not, but I would like to point out to Gary, I've listened to all of the testimony, and he actually, the first time he testified, it was actually in favor of the bill. You said that you were against it.
Could you please provide your testimony?
Yep, I will. Yeah, hello, my name is Tom Stachinski, and I also go by the name of Tom the Coin Guy. I'm the coin appraiser for Milwaukee Public Television's annual appraisal fair. I'm also a bit of a consumer advocate when it comes to coins. I started a class action lawsuit against some fraudsters who were selling coins that were improperly marked as they were not properly marked, and they looked like regular U.S. coins. I was able to settle that lawsuit and get them to properly mark the coins. The reason I am here, and the reason is because I love coins. They've really brought a lot of joy to my life. And a number of years ago, I started to become a coin dealer. And one of the things that really upsets me is that when consumers are taken advantage of. One of the things that that this bill does is it limits the number of coin shows in this state, where previously there was not a limit. And coin shows are one of the best things that are there for a consumer, because there's a lot of dealers there, and there's a lot of dealers like me that just can't stand to see someone getting ripped off. One of the examples I have is, I remember one time when this one lady came to my table, and she had these cases of gold-plated quarters, state quarters, that she had bought from a telemarketer for like $100, and she had spent like, you know, she bought four of them for her kids, and this was going to be an investment for their future. And she was telling me about it, and she asked me, you know, what I thought of it. And then I was, you know, kind of getting into the mode where, all right, how do I tell her that she was ripped off in a nice way? And I started, and I explained to her the resale of it and how it's basically just going to be worth face value. And then she looked up and she said, I'm still within the 30-day period of returning it. Do you think I should? And it just, my heart just leapt, because it's like, you know, we were able to save this person from getting ripped off. And this is not the only time that's happened. It's happened at least two or three other times where someone has come to me with something that they purchased from one of these telemarketers. And I want to talk to you a little bit about how limiting the number of coin shows that's in this bill will destroy the coin show industry in this country. I'm sorry, in this state. Right now, there are three monthly coin shows that happen on different weekends, but they happen regularly every month. And there's also a lot of other coin shows that happen that are sponsored. Most of them are sponsored by nonprofits. I'm a member of a coin club, and we have one of the largest coin shows in the state. And those also happen periodically. The problem is a lot of the current operators of these coin shows, they're barely breaking even on their table fees. If any coin dealers have to reduce the number of shows that they go to, or if they have to in some way drop out, I mean, I have one of the coin dealers, and I'm like just so impressed with him, as a 16-year-old kid, and I'm not kidding you, and he is learning so much from being at these coin shows. He's not going to be able to register. He is not going to be able to get a bond. He's going to be totally out. I'm going to be out too, because I work with in my day job, I work with regulatory compliance, and I do coins for fun. Dealing with the regulators is not going to be fun, and I'm not going to be doing it anymore. So I would ask you to please vote no on this bill. For the sake of the consumers, for the sake of coin shows. And I'd also like to point out that there's a big expansion of the products that are covered in this bill. I am pleased that at least one of the things was fixed with the A1 amendment that I was going to talk about. But thank you very much. And if anyone has any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Thank you, Mr. Staszynski. Any questions for the witness? Thank you very much, sir. Thanks for coming to the Commerce Committee. Mr. Chairman.
With that, Mr. Chair, in the interest of time, I appreciate the testimony for and against, and I would ask for member support.
Okay. Chair Hoppe renews his motion that House File 3309, as amended, be sent to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Okay, with that, is there anything else for the good of the order?
See you tomorrow.
Okay. Thanks. Good government all the time. We are adjourned.